Welcome to The Intentional Investor with Matt Ziegler, where he and his guests explore the intersection of investing and life, portfolio and purpose. Nothing in this podcast is investment advice. Nothing in this podcast is advising you to buy or sell any security or to do anything with your money. Seriously, you should only act on investment advice from someone you know and who knows your unique situation. We are not that person. Matt Ziegler is a managing director at SunPoint Investments, and the opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily reflect the opinions of SunPoint Investments or of Second Foundation Partners. Securities discussed in the podcast may be holdings of SunPoint Investments.
Welcome. Welcome to The Intentional Investor, where purpose meets portfolio, and exciting news, folks. Breaking news, dare I say. The Intentional Investor, officially an Epsilon Theory joint.
It's officially an Epsilon Theory joint. I'm so excited, man.
So excited. So please like, subscribe to the YouTube channel here. That's at Epsilon Theory on YouTube. And let me introduce you to today's guest, of course, Dr. Ben Hunt. Say hello, sir.
Hello, sir.
We're going to have some fun with this.
Good.
Wide-ranging conversation. The purpose of this is we have so many things where we talk about investment portfolios. We talk about all the Ben Graham stuff. We talk about all the theory of markets and everything else. But the thing that it always leaves me wanting is talk about, these are smart people. Let's talk about all the things behind the things behind the things behind what's going on and how they connect them together. That's what we're going to do today, Ben. I'm not even going to bother diving into your bio. You can go to Epsilon Theory. You can read the about page. We're going to talk about a lot of things, but I want to start here. Define narrative to me in your terms. Be short on this, because I'm going to follow it up with a very specific type of narrative, because I think there's a thread and I want to unravel the sweater with you.
Yeah. All right. So a narrative is a story. The way I think of a narrative is it's a script. And the fact is there are a finite number of scripts in Hollywood, in Elizabethan, play acting. There's a finite number of scripts. And it's the same with human beings. There are a finite number of stories. They have a beginning, a middle, and the end. They have an arc. We talk about a story arc. We talk about rising action and falling action. It's all the old stuff about, the hero's journey and the kind of these famous narratives and stories. But it's a finite number that incorporates so much more than that. It's little stuff too. But that's what a narrative is. It's a story that others tell us. But most importantly, and maybe this is the sweater you want to untangle, it's the stories we tell ourselves.
Because we're going to talk about how you invest in all these different parts of capital, parts of your life. Mm-hmm. And we think about those in terms of these stories and the ones we tell others, and more importantly, the ones we tell ourselves.
Yep.
There's another thing I want you to define here. What's game theory? Give me the overarching definition.
Game theory is strategic interaction. That's it. That is the definition of game theory, strategic interaction. Game theory, like the tango, takes two, right? Any sort of strategic interaction takes at least two decision makers, people, AI, whatever it is, right? And strategy is game playing. It's what do you do in thinking about, well, what is the other player going to do in reaction to what I do? And crucially, knowing that the other player is also thinking, what I do depends on what me, the other player, does. It's that back and forth. That's the mystery of, not faith, but the mystery of game theory. How can two independent thinkers, each knowing that the other player is an independent thinker, that's what game theory is. You would think it'd be like infinite regressions and there's no answer or pattern to it, but you'd be wrong, because two intelligent, independent players, you can often, depending on the starting positions and incentives and all the other stuff that goes into the game that you're playing, you can end up at a balancing point where both players are actually saying, hey, this is as good as I can get out of this. Anyway, that's what game theory is. It's strategic interaction between two or more independent decision makers.
All right. So now, narrative plus a game theory thing.
Okay.
Can you tell me a little bit about, because this is one of my favorite things that I learned from you, compare and contrast the narrative, the story of what happens in The Prisoner's Dilemma, what happens in The Stag Hunt? Why do these two games matter to you?
So these are kind of two famous games, right, that describe aspects of so many things that happen to us in our lives. And they're a particular class of games, which are called competition games. There are other types of games. There are coordination games. You know, a famous example of coordination game is, well, it doesn't really matter if we drive on the left-hand side of the road or the right-hand side of the road. What matters is that we agree, right, which side of the road we're going to drive on. That's a coordination game.
Sure.
Right? A competitive game is one where we got winners and losers, right? Or, you know, better off and worse off. We're competing with each other. Even if we love each other, right? Mm. We're still, there's a competitive aspect to what we're doing. And so these games get stylized in terms of the, we call the payoffs, right? The starting points. And what's crucial about, or the big difference between the game type that's called Prisoner's Dilemma and the game type that's called The Stag Hunt is what I was talking earlier, that there's a point where both players in the game are saying, I guess this will have to do. You know, $10 word, an equilibrium. What's the equilibrium outcome of a game? There's only one equilibrium outcome to a Prisoner's Dilemma, which is that both players rat the other guy out. That's the way that game always ends up. I'll qualify that. That's the way the game always ends up if you play it once. Because then you can find a way to say, well, you know, but most games in life, yeah, all right, I get, you know, I'm arrested by the cops and I got to, you know, turn rat on the other guy or not. That's a single play. Well, is it? Right? Because then
we saw Breaking Bad. We saw Better Call Saul. We saw The Wire.
It goes on. The game keeps on going, right? Yeah. And so if the game keeps on going, if there's a larger game that's going to be played, maybe you don't rat the other guy out. So, but what I'm describing is kind of the simple, you know, I've got the single thing. And in a single play, Prisoner's Dilemma, there's only one outcome. There's only one balancing point where that's the outcome where both players say, yeah, I'm not going to change my mind. This is where I want to be. Stag Hunt, and the name for The Stag Hunt is lesser known than Prisoner's Dilemma because we haven't, you know, we see a lot of police procedurals in our lives. But the idea of a stag hunt, Rousseau was the guy who popularized this game, is your hunters, and you can either cooperate on your hunt and work together to bring down the stag, the big deer, and man, then you eat like kings. It's great. Or, and it's an exclusive or, right? You either go out and you hunt for the stag, or your other choice is, screw the stag. I'm just going to go get a rabbit. I'm going to get a rabbit. And rabbit's not as much good eating as the stag. But I can catch a rabbit on my own. So the stag hunt game is that, well, you got two players. They don't know each other. They know that if they work together to both go out, because that's the other thing, both players have to work at bringing down the stag to get it. And then they both eat like kings. It's all great. If you go out to hunt the stag and the other guy goes out to hunt the rabbit, he gets his rabbit and you get nothing. You go hungry that night. Now, you would think, oh, well, isn't that kind of like the prisoner's dilemma? You rat out the other guy. No, it's not. It's not, because it's a great outcome if you cooperate and you both go down and take out the stag. The way it works out, the way it has two equilibrium is like this. What if you both cooperate that first day and you both go out and hunt the stag and eat like kings, you're going to do it the next day too, right? That's a very stable equilibrium. We're going to eat like kings every time we go hunt because we go out and we cooperate. We get that outcome.
So take me back on time. In time.
Okay.
You taught this stuff.
Yeah.
You taught some game theory once upon a time. You even wrote a couple of books about it, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Back in those years. So first off, how do you end up wanting this to be the course of study? And then how do you end up actually sticking around to teach it and everything else? How's that happen?
Oh, because I love games. I am a game player. And Matt, I find that most of the people in our investing lives, they love playing games. I love thinking about this stuff. Love it. Always have.
What's the first game? Like, what's the first I am addicted game?
You know, honestly, it's poker.
Okay.
My dad told me, you know, my brother and me poker, we were like, I don't know, 6 years old, we're playing poker.
Fantastic.
And it all fits together for markets, right? Because it's the game of poker is phenomenally complex, and it is a strategic interaction. You are revealing information, but you're hiding information. It's a wonderful game. Poker is a wonderful game. I love to play chess. I love to play checkers. There's game theory in chess, right? And I remember some interview where they were trying to talk. They said they recognize that there's game theory in there's strategic interaction in poker. Everybody recognizes that, but there's absolutely strategic interaction in chess. Do you play aggressively? Do you play defensively? You know, how's the other player going to react to that type of play you're doing? There's absolutely game theory, strategic interaction, even in a game that's totally out there. There's no hidden information in chess, but there's still strategic interaction.
How'd your dad teach you this? So like 6 years old, it's you and your brothers and he's dealing you in? Like how's this go down that this is the wisdom he's choosing to pass on to you at this point?
It's just the way our family was. I grew up in Alabama, outside of Birmingham. My family's been in North Alabama for a long, long time. We're the Hunts of Huntsville, of all things, you know. and by the way, not that means anything, right? Is like, we have a plaque in the big spring in the middle of town, right?
Yeah,
he was a shack, right? He wasn't a big landowner or anything. It was nothing like that. But I just remember some of my earliest memories are of game playing, betting, gambling, odds. And combine that, I'll tell you another one of my first memory. We'd spend the summers up in Scottsboro, Alabama with my grandparents. And, you know, the morning paper would come. There in the back, there was the business section, which was 3 pages of tiny, tiny print, tiniest print, tickers and prices done in eights.
Yeah.
Right? A, B, C, dash, and then, you know, whatever the price was, and then plus or minus some amount from the prior day. I would spend hours just staring at the symbols, right? It was like, I was convinced that there was a code.
Like, what's the pattern here? Or
what's the pattern?
Yeah.
That I could break the code. So I'll put it all together, right? So, you know, gambling from an early age, I still love it. I love it. I mean, I'm a degen gambler, you know, whatever. Right? But actually, I talk about this a lot. I mean, thank God online gambling didn't exist when I was in college. My life would have gone down a very different path. I know it would have. I mean, good or bad, I'm sure it'd been fine, but it would have been very different. So, gambling, looking at the code, trying to break the code of markets, the game of markets. I remember buying the book, Beat the Dealer.
And Thorpe the Warp. Classic.
I was 11 years old, right? So I'd seen Thorpe. I'd seen Thorpe on What's My Line. I'm not making this shit up, right?
Yeah,
so he was on the game show, What's My Line? And Ed Thorpe was on, you know, professional gambler. And I had $10 saved and, you know, put it in your, you know, stamped self-addressed envelope. And I sent it off to buy a copy of Beat the Dealer. And I remember my parents had to give me the $10 because that was back when, you know, you didn't have any cash yourself.
Right.
You know, it's like, this is my lawn mowing money or something. This, really? You want to do this? I said, yes. Yeah. I want to do this. And I remember that summer reading Beat the Dealer, trying to figure out the code of markets. I love to play games. I just love it. And the stock market, capital markets, it's the biggest game in the world, Matt.
It is
the biggest game in the world. That's why I love it so much.
So I'm really curious in this. So the love for games, the love for this early awareness of markets and following tickers and trying to find the pattern. I love that you didn't want to buy like the hoverboard in the back of the magazine. You wanted the gambling theory book.
Yeah.
Right. How does this... It is a classic.
It is.
Yeah, huge fan. Did definitely once try to teach a bunch of young children how to card count on like a rainy vacation. And I remember other, you know, adults and people being like, wait, what? What are you doing? And being
what are you doing? Yeah.
There's one deck of cards. They can learn to count. This is a fun application of our time.
What about sports gambling? Did you do a lot of sports gambling growing up?
No, I was not a sports gambler. Were you?
Oh, man. Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, everything was, my family and friends, you know, it was, and none of this is pro football. This is all college football. This is all college football in the South. And, oh, yeah. I mean, so I understood odds and money, you know. Anyway, I just grew up with that, and it was just part of who I am.
So that's fascinating, too, because you're actually, before you go to school for this, before you take a statistics class or something, you have an idea for how these things get set, how these things work, and an appreciation for looking at the story of what is behind this pattern and why you think it's right.
Yeah, and I look back on this and it's so weird to think about, but when I was I never took a statistics class, not in high school. I mean, it didn't have, statistics was that. But even going into college, I didn't take a statistics class. I didn't take a statistics until I was in grad school, which is really weird because this also you see in, you know, our line of business is, you know, we all have very healthy egos. And it sounds crazy, but it's actually true. Once the summer between high school and college, I invented linear regression. I did.
You incepted in your head and you were like,
linear regression, multivariate linear regression, because I was trying to figure out what companies, based on their tickers, and by this point I had learned, you know, there's fundamental information. Sure. I wanted to try to identify takeover targets.
Did you watch Ted Lasso? Were you a Ted Lasso fan? Have you seen any of Ted Lasso?
Yes, of course. Of course.
When Ted is at the bar towards the end of the show, and he basically incepts in his mind tiki-taki football. So he basically comes up with like the strategy derived years prior. That's in the book.
This
in Coach Beard's hands when they're on the plane in the very first episode, and he incepts.
That was me.
You had that moment. I love it.
I had that moment. And I spent the whole summer and I invented linear regression. I didn't do least squares. I didn't understand that more. But I invented linear regression. And if I had just taken a freaking statistics class, right, I would have had linear regression. That would be kind of day one. And who knows what I would have done accomplished. But no, I had to spend the whole summer inventing linear regression to try to predict takeover targets. Yeah, it didn't work out.
But you learned this amazing tool.
Well, amazing tool. I was doing this on my, this was back, I don't even know what we call I don't know if it was a Mac SE, you know, remember where this is the big box and the 3-inch. You know, they weren't even like floppy. It wasn't the 5 or 4 inch floppies.
But it was those other ones.
It was those little discs.
Mom was newspaper editor and whatever at this point. And so like I transitioned from learning to type on the physical typewriter that weighed more than me to then learning to type on one of those.
Exactly.
Lots of good memories of DOS prompts.
Lots of good memories, yeah. So anyway, it was all that. But it was all about trying to crack a code. Because that was the other thing I loved trying to do. I loved cryptanalysis and cryptography, all that.
Oh, so fun.
All those games. I just, word games, puzzles, riddles, gambling, cracking codes, and dealing with symbols. That's been my life as long as I can remember.
So how does this turn into the college track of study or what comes after college? Jump into this anywhere along the lines, but I'm really interested how this childhood interest morphs into the pre-finance Ben side of who you are now.
Yeah. So I didn't study economics. I studied political science, you know, that kind of oxymoron, because and this gets to the game theory, right? Mm-hmm. It's once it kind of opened up for me that there was a way to think about human power and wars and things beyond money, right? So yes, money's a form of power, but power is a much more fundamental thing. So that's why I was fascinated with politics and, you know, man's exercise of power over man.
Yeah.
Humans, that wasn't a gendered construct I was doing there, right?
Mm-hmm.
So it was this fascination with codes, this fascination with figuring out the code and the game that led me to try to figure out the math and the analytic tools, not to try to predict takeovers, but to predict wars. I was on the science side of political science, right? So political science is this, you know, this is political, you know, this bastard child of history and economics. And I was always on the economic side, the science side of political science, and trying to reduce human behaviors to the equations and the factors that drove behavior. It's weird. As I get older, I'm more on the historian side of political science, of any social science. I mean, so the being professionally in social science, it's once you play that game, that the meta game of social, being a social scientist, you get disillusioned really fast. Anyway, so, I don't know if this is where you want to go, but this is that was, I thought I could figure out the code for politics, not to make money, but to, you know, world peace, all that stuff. I was all into that. And then once I got into the actual business of being a social scientist, it just rips the joy of puzzle solving and code breaking right out of you. And B, it's just the publish or perish business reality of social science as it's done in the modern research university. It's just a terribly soul-sucking and disillusioning process. To the point, I swear I'll shut up, this is full circle. What I really loved doing was the teaching about the game theory and the solving games. But the actual business of being a social scientist, it's pretty disillusioning.
When was, and maybe it was in the creation of, because two textbooks, were they textbooks that you published?
No, not textbooks. Textbooks is how you make money.
But you didn't. Right? Why would you want to do that?
I mean, I did want to make money, there weren't textbooks. They were very typical academic publishing.
Okay. Yeah. So what, obviously not financial reward per se from those, but like, as you're on this track and you're trying to figure this thing out, what are you, like, you've must be wrestling with this whole, like, you're trying to teach, you're trying not to just do the publish or perish thing. That is not a one day you woke up and this broke you. This is probably a multi-year experience that you went through, I'm guessing.
Yeah, it was. I always saw academia as a way station, as a path to something else.
Okay.
I just didn't know what that something else would be. I actually thought it might be actual politics. I thought it might be actual politics, right? I kind of wrestled for a little bit with the idea of, you know, if you get into like really the business of academia, the administration, you know, thank God I didn't go down that path. Because that's even more soul sucking and soul destroying. But I always had the entrepreneurial bug. And for people, and I think you're this way too, it is a bug. You can't help yourself, but start businesses and companies. And so, and honestly, I was a little bit, and I say this in a non-pejorative way, but just kind of recognizing who I am, I was a little bit on the make. I did want to make money, right? I was looking for ways to make money. And writing a textbook is, anyway, for a lot of reasons, not the way to go as a junior faculty member. So I started a software company. I started a company in grad school that did these executive education programs. I met Klaus, what's his name, of the WEF doing that.
And you didn't launch the Ben Hunt Economic Forum.
No, he missed out on that. He was such a weird dude. So he was such a weird dude even then. It is all about.
This is when you're at Harvard?
Yeah. I was a grad student at Harvard. And then I kept running it the first couple of years after I went to teach at NYU. And honestly, this was part of my problem as being an academic. It was that I did want to make more money. And so I didn't play the academic game as well as I could have, should have. But anyway, I played I started this company. Oh God. I mean, I remember.
How old are you at this point? When do you start this company? And this is definitely like this. It feels like this is the transition out of academia.
I was 23.
Okay.
And it was my first year in grad school up at Harvard. And I had the idea, because I'm still trying to break the code
right
at this point. And here is where I've started looking at unstructured data and stopped looking at trying to find the patterns in, well, symbols and the tickers. I'd stopped trying to invent the formula from structured data to predict takeovers of companies. I'm trying to analyze unstructured data, stuff you read in the newspaper. It's crazy. I mean, it's weird how, you know, life comes full circle, because here I am, you know, 38 years later, and this is what I'm doing. Finally really doing it. But the idea was to try to distill published information into the essence of that information. I didn't have words like narrative and language models or natural language processing. I didn't have those words. And I had too much ego to actually take courses in this stuff. So it was all just me trying to figure it out on my own.
It was all linear regression all over again.
Yeah, it really was. It was inventing linear regression all over again. And God, when I look back, I mean, it's amazing how ego gets in the way. Right? I mean, I learned so much doing this stuff.
Right.
But, you know, part of me thinks, God, you know, should have done a better job playing the game.
Well, you're cracking the code still. So,
but see, the cracking the code said, I couldn't quite get there. I couldn't raise money for cracking the code. What I could raise money for was to put on executive education programs.
Right.
At Harvard. And, oh man. And so that was my introduction, my first kind of real introduction to the business of academia.
Tell me what happens with the program. I've heard you tell this story before, but this is a great story.
It's a good story. So Harvard's mantra when it comes to the business of academia is every tub on its own bottom, which is a fancy way of saying that the business school gets to make a lot of money and they don't have to share it with the other schools that are part of Harvard University. The poorest of the schools is the Harvard Education School. I don't think they're still the poorest of the schools, because they now do all the online programs and stuff, and I'm sure they make a ton of money. But this is their first effort with this stuff, and I said, look, you're a school. You can issue a certificate that says Harvard University on it. So my idea was, let's put on a 1-week leadership conference. You're an education school. It can be a conference about leadership. And we'll market it to CEOs in Southeast Asia. Because the farther away you get geographically from Harvard, the bigger the name. We'll charge them a lot of money. And I'll use some of the money. I'm going to hire business school professors to come and give lectures. And they're on the make too. So, you know, it was $5,000 I'd pay, you know, Michael Porter to come over and give an hour talk on something he's given a million times before. And nobody really even cares what he's saying. They just want to say, oh, you know, I went to this class with Michael Porter. And for an hour, he gets $5,000. And you do this for 3 or 4 days. You put him up at the Ritz. This is back when the Ritz was actually a, you know, fancy hotel there in Boston. Give him some nice dinners. You have an award ceremony where the dean of the ed school hands them their certificate that says Harvard School of Education on it. And everyone's happy. So I did this for 3 or 4 years. It's funny. What I've learned so much is how many academic administrators kind of got their start doing stuff like this. Whether it's executive education programs or test preparation services. That was one that I looked into. I rented space. I hired grad students to do test prep services. But this is the one I really stuck with. I said, I'm an entrepreneur. I can't help myself but do this stuff. So this was all going well. And like 3 years into it, by this point, I'd gotten my PhD. So it's more than 3 years, like 4 years into it. I was teaching at NYU, which then was a little weird because I was a junior professor at NYU, but I'm associated with the Harvard program. So, you know, what did I call myself when I went to, Southeast Asia to go to the alumni
different meetings? Business cards for different situations, basically.
My God. Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
In the business card days. Yeah.
Business cards were key. Business cards were key and quite the kind of tricky, to loop that. So I had to keep some sort of appointment still at Harvard so I could still have a Harvard card. Anyway, yes, these were all very key things. And I was in Jakarta because we hadn't had a lot of people from Indonesia come. So this was a real opportunity for the leadership conference at the Harvard School of Education. And I saw there was a business school professor there who was connected with one of the business school professors that I would hire a lot. And so I reached out to him, to his office. And this set off all kinds of alarm bells in this guy's head, because unbeknownst to me, Harvard Business School was trying to set up an actual offshoot, a bricks and mortar program in Indonesia as just a pure money-making, land grab over there. So he thought I was actually over there trying to somehow horn in on his turf. So this gets back to whoever was the dean of the business school at the point in time. And so there's a meeting with in Larry Summers' office. I mean, it's just like, you've seen the social country, where the Winklevii twins are in, Summers' office. I had one of those meetings. I actually wasn't there at the meeting.
Yeah.
It was between It took place between the dean of the business school, the dean of the head school, where they hashed it out, where they hashed me out. That was a problem.
Yeah.
So the solution they came up with was that, all right, the ed school eliminates the leadership conference. I'm out. Going forward, though, every year, the business school paid the ed school a couple of million bucks, more than they were making from the leadership conference, to basically buy them out to keep the executive education firmly in the business school's hand. True story.
Is this part of you? It's not cynicism. It's not being jaded. I mean, label it that if you want to label it that, but what is the final stroke that pushes you out of trying to do this academic? I almost think it's like without being entrepreneurial and the starting a business from scratch, like people who put this stuff together are being entrepreneurial inside of a construct, like inside of academia, figuring out how to do this. And it's really interesting.
Yeah.
Cooperation and competitive games that get there.
So this was kind of early in my career, right? I'm a junior professor at NYU while all this happens, but this is my first exposure to what I've now learned to be true, which is that academia, it's a church. Mm. I wrote a note about how it's the equivalent of the, medieval Catholic Church. No, it really is. It's a church where you are a priest. And you genuflect to the dogmas and the catechisms and all like that you're a priest, and it's a corrupt church, meaning that it is administered in the way that I'm sure churches have been from time immemorial. When they get really big, they're administered for money, and property. That's it, brother. That's what they're administered for. And the business of academia is just so fucking hypocritical. And yet you stay because the actual teaching is a joy. And in the way I'm sure that so many priests stay in the church, because the ministry, man, that's the best. Teaching's phenomenal. If that's your personality, to kind of be on stage and be a teacher, it's great. And the other great thing is, nobody tells you what to do with your time. So you can spend all day, and I did, thinking about codes to crack and problems to solve. So intrinsically, academia, the church, the modern church, the actual activities that you do that allows you to think without somebody telling you what to think and what to work on. I could work on whatever I wanted to. That freedom, that intellectual freedom, combined with the ability to get on stage and teach a class, it's pretty great. It's pretty great. And that's why it just is so awful that it's embedded within this edifice of making money and acquiring property.
So it pushes you out of that. How do you, it doesn't have to be a moment. What takes you away from that?
Well, you can be taken out of it because you don't get tenure.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So this was the kind of the other kind of lesson I learned. And this is kind of also kind of church and anyone you tell this to, I'd hear the story today and I'd go, well, duh. Right. So I actually did pretty well. I was publishing. I was a really good teacher. I was doing the right things. I hitched my wagon to a new chair of the department who came in at NYU. I said, all right, he gets me. And I'm going to be his guy, and he's going to help me get tenure. And then he didn't, right? There were other, anyway, it's all that usual political stuff, right? Yeah. So I didn't get tenure. I mean, that was a real blow. Now I ended up, so I gave some job, and I got tenure at SMU.
Okay.
But in prestige terms, that's a big step down.
Yeah.
From NYU. And so when I'm thinking about my career in academia, it was different. Now, look, I love so many of the people at SMU because mm-hmm. it was much more about the teaching. I still had the freedom to think and do what I wanted to do. It didn't have a graduate program, which was wonderful because most graduate programs are just money making. They're horrible things. They're horrible things. So I enjoyed my time, but that's the point where that entrepreneurial bug I had, it just kept bubbling up. That I started a computer game company based on these simulations I had done for classroom teaching around game theory, actually.
Yeah.
And it was just like, there are so many aspects I love about the church of academia, the ministry and the like, but it became very confining. So I took a sabbatical to work on my computer game.
Yeah.
And then after that, I was like, once you step out of the church, right, it's really, and I think this is true about kind of any field you're in, wouldn't you kind of cheat on them, right?
Yeah, and not in the Rumspringa sense. Like, not in the exactly. permissible you can step outside
right.
sense. In the,
right.
oh, you've stepped out of the door.
You don't come back easily. And so it was like, I just couldn't fight that entrepreneurial bug anymore. So I started a software company. And that's what got me out of academia.
So
I left a tenured job. It's crazy.
How old are you at this point?
I am 30. It's 1999, 35.
Married at this point?
Yeah. Yeah. Married with two little girls. Married with two little girls.
So you leave tenure to start the software company. I'm sure your wife and kids are all thrilled about this decision at the time.
Well, you know, that's it. And I think this will ring true to a lot of people as well. So my wife was a lawyer. We're in Dallas. I am teaching at SMU. I'm a tenured professor at SMU. So I teach 2 days a week. I play golf 3 times a week. Not at a country club. Godfrey, no. At the public course, right? So we walk the public course. Right. A couple of the guys, you know, other guys there. I mean, this is not, when I say play golf, this is like $9, you know, to play 18 holes playing golf, right? Where you're pulling your car. You know. So this isn't a money thing. On the contrary, right?
Right.
We've got two little kids. I'm home by 3 in the afternoon. I could have been home all day, at least a couple of, but I'm always home by 3 o'clock. We had hired a nanny, some grandma from Mesquite, Texas, to help. I mean, again, it's all stupid. Because my wife, she's working early morning. Like, she's working at, she's a big litigation firm there in Dallas, and she's working like a dog. And we've got these two little kids. And so, you know, it's 5 o'clock in the afternoon. I'm out at the park with the two little girls. It's kind of, you know, I'm kind of bored with it. I'll talk to my wife on, you know, cell phone, and I was like, yeah, it's fine. And then I'm hanging out. I'm just lying in the room, you know, watching, you know, Xena Warrior Princess with the older of the two. And it's like nothing to me. And it's like killing my wife, because it's everything she wants, right? She wants that time.
And Xena would have spoken to her in a different way. And Xena may have spoken, to her in a different way.
So it was a joint. It was our first really big decision as a married couple to make a big change. For me to start working a lot harder in a startup, with a very uncertain future, like all startups are.
Mm-hmm.
And, for Jennifer to stay at home with the two girls that soon became four girls. It was a big change in our life. We both took an enormous risk. I think Jennifer taking a bigger risk than I did, because my change was embracing my identity, and her change was too, that aspect of her identity, but she had to give up a big chunk of her identity, right? Law school, the big time, you know, the career, all that. And that was a lot. I didn't recognize it at the time, though, how much it was. Anyway, we're still happily married. So this all has a happy ending. And this was a big change we both made to really upend our lives.
Take me from whatever happens to startup to presumably the finance chapter that comes after.
Yeah. So the startup was also dealing with unstructured data, and it was based on a computer graphics program. And again, all self-taught, right? So I just keep coming back to this, and it's like, God, what could I have done if I'd actually, you know, trained on this shit, right? So I was a
become a tenured professor. That's what you could have done, but
yeah. I mean, anyway, it's I feel like so, in so much of my life, I have a, I'm sure you know classic comic books, right? Where the, you know, Robert Louis Stevenson, you know, or, you know, Moby Dick is reduced to a comic book form.
This is all my summer vacations as a child. So yes, yeah, reading
this. This is how I've gone through my life, right? So my knowledge of so much is like classic comic book deep, right? But I can pass as if I've really read Moby Dick. I'm really good at that, right? I'm good at passing like I've read the old Moby Dick when actually my knowledge of it is, well, I read the classic comic book.
My wife was laughing at me. We were, took like a weekend getaway and we're in this very old hotel in a historic central Pennsylvanian town. And she comes like into the room or whatever. And I'm sitting on the bed with, they had like the like vintage Reader's Digest books in the hotel rooms instead of like the Bible. And yeah. I was like, I've never really read Bronte. But like, this is how, like.
Right.
This is my connection to so much classic literature. It's based on these weird Reader's Digest abridged versions.
That's right. Reader's Digest. My mother's mother had, my other grandmother had, right. I've read all of the Reader's Digest.
Yep.
That and my collection of jokes, you know, life in these United States, right?
Humor, fantastic. Yeah. The best, those books too.
Yeah. Anyway, right. So I've got a very thin amount of information about a lot of things, but I pass like I know it pretty well. I know just enough to be a little dangerous, but there are when it comes to language, whether it's a computer language or whether it's English language and writing, it all somehow comes together for me.
Mm-hmm.
So we started a software company on some shit I wrote and necessity is the mother of invention, right? This is all still around unstructured data. So the software was graphic software to basically take bitmapped drawings, renderings, and put them into vector for parts diagrams and schematics for construction equipment of all things. I guess it shows because how desperate I was to get out of academia. This friend of mine who's a consultant for Caterpillar, he had an idea to start this. And we started this in 1999. So this is at the pinnacle of, we're going to build a portal. This is our original idea. It's going to be a portal for the construction equipment rental industry. Whatever the hell that means. We had no idea what that meant. It was going to be a portal. And then we actually start the company, we incorporate, we get our funding in March of 2000. To the day when the NASDAQ bubble bursts, that's when we start.
Yeah.
And I've left academia and all this, and we're living in this duplex up in Connecticut. NASDAQ bursts. We've got this idea for a portal. And it's like, okay, what do we do? And so I remember this day. So it's funny just having this conversation. For 3 weeks, I locked myself into this room, the one spare room we had in the duplex, and I just figured this shit out, right? And it just had a really cool interface. So it kind of looked like you were flying through the machine. And then because you had transformed the bitmaps into vectors, you could attach code to it, which in this case would be parts inventory. And somehow I just figured that shit out. And that became the company that I ended up leaving after 3 years because my partner, and this is probably the right decision, right? So my vision was, and this is another thing. Well, this is like therapy, Matt, this kind of conversations. I'll get into something and I'll break the first code. I'll figure out the first puzzle. And then what I want to do is, okay, now let's apply it to a much bigger ass puzzle.
Right.
Right. So the initial software, and I mean, it was basically a scripting language that I had a comic book's knowledge of. And then we ended up hiring an actual CTO and staff. So it actually became real software, real mm-hmm. code, as opposed to the whatever scripting thing I was doing. You know, it's probably like Flash, Adobe Flash or something crazy, stupid.
It might
like
not
that,
even right. been Flash.
Right. It might not be Flash. Right? But once we had done this for construction equipment rental, I said, oh shit, we can do this for any sort of equipment. Otis Elevator, right up the road. Let's do it for elevators, which actually Otis is a fascinating company. They call it
Utterly
the Glacier because it never changes. And every elevator is unique. Every elevator has its own unique set of schematics and stuff, which makes them really hard to read. Anyways, we can digitize all of this. We can make it smart. We tie it into infrastructure. GE Power. Oh my God. We did this little test run for what they do for their manuals on these gas turbines. It's like, oh geez, we can save GE. We can save them $50 million a year on maintenance. Let's go. Let's do that. And my partner said, no, I want to stay in construction equipment rental. And it was right. Honestly, it was the right decision. It's the right decision. But again, once I kind of put my foot out and I was kind of looking and seeing something bigger, my heart was never in it again. And so I ended up leaving.
Left on your own volition. You're just,
oh yeah.
It's time for me to move on.
It's time for me to freaking move on to solve another puzzle because I'm going to be here. And look, the company ended up, took a long time, but ended up getting sold for a lot of money. My stock would have been all worthless anyway, but by all the dilution and everything that happened by the end. So that's not the regretful part. What I couldn't see myself doing was staying in a company and doing the same puzzle over and over and over again. I needed more puzzles. And that's eventually how we come to the stock market. Come full circle back to looking at the little symbols, the little tickers as a six-year-old boy saying, there's a pattern here. I just know it, to play the biggest game in the world. And that's how my buddy got me to come work at his firm. He said, look, we're always talking about companies and stuff. This is like third dog for deals for the venture group that had funded our software. And I was looking. Said, look, it's the biggest game in the world.
Who's this buddy? Right. Who's this buddy, and what's the first job look like? Or to the degree you want to disclose, you don't have to disclose names.
No. We had actually met way back in NYU days. He was an older student. He had kind of come back to academia, but he was from Wall Street, and at this time, he was the director of research at a long-only shop here in Westport, and they were going to start an internal long-short fund with employee money. And he told me this, and I thought, oh, so, a couple of $1,000. He said, no, $10 million. And I went, what? I was coming in. It's like,
yeah.
Anyway, the money is crazy. That's the employee money? He said, oh, yeah. Right. Okay. And so he said, look, just come and we'll do this together. And, I think you'd be good at it. And I was really good at it because it was just every day was a different puzzle for me to try to solve. And I didn't come out of Wall Street at all. Which was the best thing. Because I wasn't infected with the way of thinking. Because Wall Street can be a church too. Right? Where here's the value church, or here's your, growth church, whatever your religion is and investing. I didn't know. I didn't come into it like that. So it was a new puzzle to solve every day. It was the first time since I've been in academia where I had the time to say, to explore. Oh, I remember when I first got my Bloomberg terminal, like little card, and just, I just couldn't believe how much information was there. Just a kid in a candy store. Kid in a candy store. And it, I, the big deal for us. So we did well in 05, and I was kind of learning the ropes in 05, 06, and 07. And there were a couple little things where I did that I did really well. Like, I put a big short on the online, offshore, poker companies, Party Gaming, NetTeller. I had a big short on the for-profit education guys, which took a while to work, but when it worked, it was amazing.
But these shorts are on online gambling, for-profit ed.
Stuff I knew about.
You knew a thing or two about these.
I knew a thing or two about them, right? And the other thing I knew about was that I spoke the language of the ratings agencies. So the big break, the big moment was in late 07, going into 08, when I started looking at mortgage-backed securities. And we were focused on equity, so it was, you know, we'd get, because we were part of a larger shop, a larger long-only shop, all the road shows would come through, all the sell side analysts would come through, all the red herring, the prospectuses would be dropped off, and I'd get a copy in my office. Now, I remember asking the head of the firm, learned a lot of lessons from him. What do I do with these, David? And he said, I can't do the accent, but so I won't even try it here. You put them in a corner of your office and you just let them stack up, because when this market turns, those are going to be all your shorts. Those are all going to be your shorts right there. And so many of them in my stack were financial services companies, something to mortgage servicers, you know, CDS, Monoline, blah, blah, blah. And so I, in early 08, I started looking through these because it felt wrong. Even in Q4 of 07 for us, it felt wrong. We started getting short, net short in Q4 of 07. And so I was looking at all, you know, the ratings agencies, the model lines, and I realized, oh, I actually speak this language, the language of a Gaussian copy. I mean, I actually, actually know this language. And it's because none of the models or any of this, none of it was secret. It was just in a language that most people couldn't speak. And I spoke the language. I didn't come from Wall Street, so I wasn't already in the religion that, oh, these guys are great and they know what they're doing. In this super, I've got this short seller's mentality. I'm always finding the flaw in things, because it's how you solve a puzzle. You find the flaw, right? There's the crack in the puzzle. And it was just like, oh my God, this the entire US housing market is like an inverted pyramid. That if the core assumption, the point of the inverted pyramid is that it is impossible, not just unlikely, but it is impossible to have a nationwide decline in home prices. Impossible. And honestly, if you look at the last 60 years or however many the data was, it's like, okay, there hasn't been one. But I was looking at this, and because I was looking at how they structure these things, is like, well, if that assumption is in fact violated, it all comes tumbling down. This ship that's, you know, AAA tranche, you know, can't be touched ever, it all comes tumbling down. So we did really well in 08. I mean, we were up 20-something percent, you know, net, which was super. But and people say, oh, how'd you do it? And all like that. And it's totally the wrong question. The right question is, knowing what you knew and figuring that shit out, why weren't you up 80%? Why were you only up 20%? And the answer is, again, because I just keep doing the self-taught thing. So I taught myself, you know, how to trade CDS, right? So I was just doing it in very little bits, and it was lucky, right? Because I didn't get my face ripped off when you had recoveries and stuff, but we did just enough, and we actually ended up doing really well. And that was the year that kind of made it for the fund, and then the money started flowing in.
I think it's also amazing with so many of those stories from the financial crisis period. It's like you made it, but you also got some off the table. You didn't screw it up at the end. Did you guys make it all the way through that period?
Yeah. We did. And I remember this so vividly. In March of 09,
when the market, equity markets bottom.
Bottom, it came roaring back.
Yeah.
It was like, okay, I get why, you know, we were due for a bounce then in March. We were still short. So we'd done really well in January and February.
Yeah.
Lost a little money in March. Said, all right, I get that. April, markets lost a little bit, 09. And then May, there was an enormous crap rally.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I was still scratching, trying to figure this out. And by crap rally, I mean, look, in March, it was, you know, great companies beaten down. I mean, my God, you know, the S&P was 666, on March 9th.
And it was, we got some relief into January or whatever, completely puked on new big lows in March. And then we go through that.
Right. So the recovery in March was like, okay, we were due. That makes sense. Quality. So, you know, is all good. The rally in May, and then it was either June or July, is like every other month, it would be this face ripping, if you're short, crap rally, where it was the crappiest companies that, you know, that rallied enormously. And we ended up actually making a little money in 09, but we didn't make the turn. I'd still, you know, I am a short seller at heart. I am seeing the flaw in things and trying to figure out, well, what's the puzzle to make it go wrong, as opposed to, yes, that contrarian in me.
Right.
So we ended up making some money in 09. And we made money every year. We never lost money for our clients, which I'm still really proud of. But So 9, we made some money. 10, we made a little bit of money. 11 was a tough year for a lot of value shops, because that's when, you know, the first kind of Europe thing happened.
Yeah. Grexit was on the things. We had all the wildness, right?
But I figured a lot of that out. It was the European banks were having their first kind of tremor of troubles.
Right.
I figured that out. But what was clear to me by 11 was that the fundamentals, right, which was what our firm was built on and what our process, right? Fundamentals, you know, value with a catalyst. What I finally realized after whatever this was, so from 05 to 2010, 11, was that the catalyst are all stories. They're all narratives. The dynamics are all game theory. It's all strategic interactions of market participants, of market players. Nothing to do with the fundamentals, nothing to do with company earnings. It was two things. It's flows, right? Which is game theory. and narrative, particularly central bank narrative. And that was the moment that once I had that realization, it was like me stepping out again, because I couldn't go back to being a value investor, value with a catalyst investor. It didn't work. It didn't work. So I ended up, I got a divorce from my partner. Because it was the thing. Once I can't pursue the puzzle, because now the puzzle is, all right, if it's flows, game theory, and narrative, words, let's figure that out. Let's figure that puzzle out. And I couldn't do it within the confines. And
anyway,
and so we ended up giving all the money back and wound down the firm, not because we lost money, but because I lost my faith in value investing. And there was a new, bigger puzzle to solve. That was a rough time. That was a rough time personally.
That's a lot, not just because the financial crisis was a lot for everybody. You had friends and other people going through all sorts of stuff.
Yeah.
That's a tough piece of it. What about that decision to exit that, to shut that down?
Yeah.
How's that? Is that another big family decision? Is that you and your wife talking about, I'm ready to leave another church?
We were able to have, how to say this without coming across wrong. I don't know how to say this right. I had a good payday, a couple of good paydays, right? So we had some money set aside, and, I always think I've got the puzzle figured out even before I have. So I was just certain that I'd be able to go quickly into something else to figure out, to solve the puzzle. And my wife trusted me on this, because it's trust is a big part of it. But the other part of it is that once in your heart you've left, you can't stay. I had to leave. And I wish I had left better. And, you know, these situations are never easy. In retrospect, from a professional career point of view, it was such a smart thing to do, just to give the money back. Because like I say, we never lost money for our clients. And, you know, I'm a big fan of The Godfather, right? That's what Hyman Roth said. You know, that's the secret. You always make money for your partners. So it was the right time, but it was very wrenching. And, you know, it was something you've built, and it all goes away. So that was tough. And then I had to figure out, well, how do we solve this puzzle?
So how'd you solve it?
Took a long time.
Yeah.
And again, kind of, you know, thinking back at this is every game I play. So I'll use poker as an example. I'm a perfectly good amateur poker player. I think I'm better at most with other people. And, you know, just from birth, I've been thinking in terms of bets, right? So I'm a perfectly good amateur player. I'm not better than that. But in like, I'll go to a new game, new group of people, college, grad school, whatever. The first time I play, I will lose money. Second time I play, I'll probably lose money. sometime between the third and the fifth round or game, or, you know, in investing, it would be a kind of a month of performance, right? So around the third, fifth, I'll have an amazing, you know, period. And I'll have convinced myself, oh, I figured it all out. And then over the next 10 periods, you know, there'll be one or two where you give most of that back and say, you don't know shit, right? You haven't figured it all out. And then, you know, it's that trough and then you go through and then you really start figuring it out. And that's what it took with figuring out, well, how do we make sense of narrative for alpha, for making money? And I did it basically through writing. That's when I started Epsilon Theory. It was in 2013. I didn't know what I was doing. And I do remember I'm sitting there at the computer and I'm writing kind of the manifesto. I mean, how egomaniacal is that, right? You write something, you call it a manifesto. I mean, Lord, I look back at this stuff. It's like, God, but I'm writing this. And I remember my wife coming into this, you know, our little office there at home. And she says, what are you doing? And she's kind of saying like, what are you doing? And I said, well, I think I've got something to say. And she literally patted me on the shoulder. He said, well, I guess you better do that then. And I did have something to say, which was, it's not fundamentals. Value is a story. It's stories all the way down. And we got to find ways to find the structure in unstructured information. And that was the start of Epsilon Theory. That's the Epsilon. It's not the error term. It's not randomness. There's actual structure in the unstructured. And that was the start. I found a great partner in Rusty Quinn. You know, I found in other people who were down there at Salient, the firm I went to join, and they had read some of the stuff I was writing and really liked it. So I was able to get a job where I didn't have to sell. I didn't have to sell product. I mean, if I got advice, right, it's in how you deal with money and a career in investing is, if you're trying to figure something out, don't put yourself in a position where you have to sell, because it limits
it's still where you stand as a function of where you sit.
Exactly. So I found a great spot with some great people that gave me the time again to solve the puzzle and try to figure it out. We're just getting there. It's the same stuff I was doing 36 years ago in grad school. It's just now we have big data and big computing power. So all the stuff that, you know, my little Mac and we'd actually have, you know, punch cards, but it's basically the same thing where you'd write something and then you'd have to wait a day for the program to compile and give you some information. To be able to do that, you know, essentially instantaneously, that's what changes everything. The tools for figuring this stuff out have gotten so much better. But that's what I'm still trying to do. So still having fun, right? Because it's all, the game of markets is a game. And I love trying to figure out the puzzle. And I love the teaching and getting on stage and writing about it.
I'm going to land this conversation here and do it with some notes. Because you know I'm going to take you out with some notes. But I know we're going to continue this. There's definitely a follow-up episode in here somewhere. And maybe this is part of when we get together in Nashville at Vanderbilt for Epsilon Connect in June of this year. But I want to bring this here because I think you just landed us on what the point of this YouTube channel, what the point of this whole thing is. And it's uncovering these intentions. I started you off talking about what is story? And you explained it as the stories we tell ourselves and the stories we tell others, but really the stories we tell ourselves.
Yeah.
Asking about what is game theory and what are these different types of cooperative and competitive games that you laid out. And then the financial part is the easy one. That's everybody listening to this, everybody in the financial space, you get it. You get the wins, you get the glory, you get the paydays, you get the things that come out of you did the thing right. And the biggest, what's the point of this? The biggest financial payoff besides the things that provide for your family and take care of things is the knowledge that comes out of doing those things. Because that's your human capital story is repeatedly going into a church or figuring out you're in a church and then going, oh, I know something and I'm going to step outside. And then once you're outside the church, you see the edifice, you see the artifice, you see the presentation of the story you told yourself inside the church, the story they're telling themselves about their church and why you're a part. Your human capital development, the way you've developed your career, to see things that are beyond the money at each phase. I encourage people to go back and think about this, like trying over and over again to reduce human behaviors down to its driving factors and over again, finding the human behavior driving you and your family is the thing that's pushing this out. That's a really profoundly beautiful thought. When you connected this back then to, again, on the job journey, the intellectual capital, going from publisher parish and having it feeling yick, the Harvard certificate school. And I love the idea of the certificates and then the business cards with the multiple names on it next to each other.
Oh yeah.
But what more is intellectual capital leading all the way up to 2013 and starting in Epsilon Theory, but just the basics of comic book abridged editions to come to an understanding? Like everything gets reduced down to the abridged edition in comic book form. It's not Moby Dick. It's not the whole mess of, I wish I had it closer to me because I would pull it off the shelf. It's a big book. And there's a lot that happens after, you know, call me Ishmael or whatever the famous opening line is.
Exactly. Call me Ishmael.
But you can reduce it to a comic book to get that understanding. And that intellectual capital of figuring out how to reduce is so powerful. Now, the thing you never lose sight of, and this is profound to me too, is the social aspects of what you're building along the way. Because as you keep piecing together the next piece of the puzzle in the intellectual story, you keep also piecing together, you have the competitive turned or cooperative turned competitive lesson at the Harvard Business School with the run-in in Indonesia and Jakarta.
Yeah.
Like you found out that it was a stag hunt and you might have been the stag.
Yeah, pretty much. Exactly.
you found out at, you know, at 35 years old, this family decision to totally upend your life with your wife and the two kids and go join the startup. And then, man, the thing I don't want to say I love it the most, but I truly, truly love the idea of your finance career comes out of, and correct me if I'm wrong, an NYU, but older than you friend who is like, come manage the partner's money.
Just a relationship, just happenstance.
The social capital, the network drives the intellectual capital, drives the financial capital. It all connects back. It changes this development, this evolution. And last but certainly not least on this journey is, I didn't get to ask you about what you want to pass down to your kids, but probably because I feel like I know. Your dad's the one who taught you poker.
Yeah. Yeah.
He incepted the bug.
He did. It's true.
He gave you a version of the white whale. That idea of game playing, betting, gambling, odds that is incepted as a kid turns into the reality of being in the church. Like the fun of being in the church is the joy of teaching and thinking inside of this stuff. But the part that was always lacking and the part that I feel like you learned in a way from your dad was this, the freedom to do is the most important thing.
Right on, man.
You can't make and teach alone. You have to do too. And I'm going to take us out on the quote from your wife. If you can't just make, you can't just teach, you have to do. You have to do something with it. Even if that thing doesn't scale, even if that thing doesn't ultimately profit beyond belief, knowing you have to step outside the church and go off and do something. You said, I have something to say. Your wife said, I guess you better do that.
I guess you better do it.
You, my friend, are an intentional investor. Thank you so much for doing this with me.
Thank you, Matt. This is great.
Thanks for tuning in. Be sure to like, share, and subscribe wherever you're watching The Intentional Investor so more people can find our show. You can follow Matt directly at cultishcreative.com or at cultishcreative on Twitter. For more great content at the intersection of investing and life, check out epsilontheory.com or at epsilontheory on Twitter.